And welcoming you to this morning's session of My Sunday Morning Take, dear listeners. And the songs that we were just left with came from, Bebe and Sean Lee, obviously a producer and an artist, together with the song Bossa Rossa. And before that, you heard a little bit of Andre Adriana with That's All Right With Me. Welcoming you on what isn't chilly, but my ride here was slightly chilly. Could barely feel my legs. I did make a calculation that potentially would be the issue for me. And obviously, as we find ourselves here on the Sunday morning, where we always look into the interesting but rather quirky but also novel discussions that we don't have during the course of the week here on Eagle FM, but we can actually contain within the next 2 hours, so specifically from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. here on Eagle FM. Now, our discussion finds ourselves for this morning with an interesting one, because primarily it's probably the biggest aspect on planet Earth that has yet to be fully discovered, fully explored, and thus also to be understood to its entirety. But it actually starts from another particular setting. The setting is one based upon, you know, obviously environmental protection, and as well as also having a basic consensus of countries and nations between each other regarding this particular resource. And this resource is the world's oceans. Now, the world's oceans is currently being governed by a treaty known as the High Seas Treaty, or the Law of the High Seas. It's pretty straightforward. It came into effect in 2023. There's still a few guys, once again, a few countries who need to identify what part they wish to play part of, and how they're also going to respect the same particular resource. This is not, this is not similar to the debates regarding the overall climate protection or climate change, discussion between countries that take place annually, wherein the accusations, obviously, from what I saw back in 2024, in Azerbaijan's particular engagement, was that countries specifically like India and the small island nations felt that something was being imposed on them. Now, in essence, the imposition seems to be specifically from a European perspective regarding, whether or not these countries still need to utilize the fossil fuels. But the major question obviously has been, okay, so how do you, how do you basically replace what they're currently busy with? And specifically a country like India, they also have large industrial activities. Such activities obviously include one of the world's biggest smelting companies, iron ore smelting or metal smelting companies, that being Mittal. ArcelorMittal, sorry, that's the company's name. Because Mittal bought Arcelor. They were two competitors in the global industry. So the scenario that you've got to look at is that they will rely on energy generation that still comes through from the fossil fuel scenario or the fossil fuel axis. Now, turn that slightly, the overall climate change discussion, into one for the seas, which is, as I mentioned, Earth's largest, probably underexplored and underdiscovered area on the planet. Now, the High Seas Treaty, basically, speaks towards, certain particular parts of do's and don'ts, what you can do as a country and what you can't do, how you need to operate or be part of the overall discussion. But this wasn't the scenario before this particular treaty. This has been a treaty that had been in the making for like a couple of decades. Okay, a couple of decades is technically 20. Because it's more than 20 years that this treaty had been in formation. And this treaty is obviously a UN treaty that comes through from this. Now, the High Seas Treaty highlights a specific zone around countries. The High Seas Treaty speaks to all parts of the sea that are not included in an exclusive economic zone, in the territorial seas, or in the internal waters of a state. And internal waters are rivers. And the treaty also speaks to any archipelagic waters of an archipelagic state, meaning a country made up of a cluster of islands. And it also notes that this particular treaty does not entail any abridgment of the freedoms enjoyed by all states in exclusive economic zones in accordance with Article 55. Now, Article 7 actually broadens that, of the specific treaty. The high seas are open to all states, but whether coastal or landlocked, freedom of the high seas is exercised under the conditions laid down by the convention and by other rules of the international law. It comprises inter alia, which includes everything, both for coastal and landlocked countries, meaning what it allows for is freedom of navigation, freedom of overflight, freedom to lay submarine cables and pipelines, freedom to construct artificial islands and other installations permitted under international law. And that's one of the biggest complaints lodged specifically against China, because China is constructed a whole bunch of islands, in order to extend its coastline, because you basically extend your coastline. Then they've got freedom of fishing, which is subject to the conditions laid down in another section, and freedom of scientific research, which is also subject to other parts of the treaty as well. Then there's also an important thing, a very crucial thing for the High Seas Convention specifically, which is Article 88, which speaks towards that the high seas will be maintained for friendly use, or for peaceful purposes, is the other term that you see. Meaning, don't use the high seas to wage war. Which is a big negative, because primarily it is in the high seas that the Americans attacked that recent Iranian warship that that participated in a naval exercise in India and was on its way back to Iranian waters, and then got attacked in international waters by the American submarine or the American warship. Article 89, which speaks of the invalidity of claims of sovereignty over the high seas, because this had been an issue priorly before, meaning that no state, no country may validly purport to subject any part of the high seas as part of its sovereignty, meaning just because I sail here, or my boats have historically sailed here between this destination and that destination, I claim this part as part of my territorial waters and special economic zone waters around my country. No, you can't do that. Which is, once again, a little bit of an interesting thing, because primarily, if you did not know, there are three navies that are technically roaming the seas. And when I say roaming, they roam, acting also as law enforcement on the high seas. So it's the British Navy, and it's also the American Navy. So the British Navy specifically has certain kinds of treaties with small island nations in the Commonwealth, wherein specifically they are helped with combating illegal trades like the drug trade, the narcotics trade, as well as also other particular trades of smuggling, and usually it's theft and piracy, and so on and so forth. I watched one such particular, what they call it, documentary about the British Navy sailing to go and help with a destruction of a cannabis plantation on a island. But I just can't remember if it was in the Atlantic or if it was in the Pacific. One of the two. And they actually destroyed the particular illegal plantation. But the thing was specifically, the particular detail that stood out the most was for how long the ship's crew had actually been on the sea. And had been in technically, you know, on the boat, on the ship together, since the last time that they were at home. And it is actually it's a pretty surprising thing, because imagine that there's a lot more of these potential countries that do the same thing. They just sail everywhere. The submarines of various superpowers sail everywhere. You wouldn't know it, because you obviously don't have the opportunity to see. This is not data that's also easily published. You just don't know it. It also speaks towards another scenario in terms of how you look at the high seas in itself. Is the high seas like a major shipping lane or a major corridor for transport and shipments and shipping and for goods and service to move between continents? Yes, it is. And primarily, it's the only particular thing that is not claimed or cannot be claimed by this convention in terms of saying, hey, listen, we claim the whole North Atlantic, which the British used to do. It's one of the few things that technically cannot be claimed as much. Not like what they do with air and land, obviously, which is air is obviously above the land, and you know there's this 360 degree protection discussion that has to take place. Now, with that particular introduction set aside, we quickly take another short musical break, and we'll come back right after this, dear listeners, heading into the quirks of where and how this particular high seas treaty actually started from, because it did start from precursor agreements, and I'm talking about global agreements, agreements that sometimes, in some cases, US, Namibia, you didn't know existed, but it still probably exists. And we'll be back right after this.
time on the Trinity River, gold jewelry, all black tinted loafers.
Put the rain.
And as we come back there, specifically from the musical break, there was a little bit of Keane with Put the Radio On. Before that, it was a little bit of Leon Bridges with That's What I Love. And once again, a little bit of Bebe and Sean Lee with Year of the Funky. The High Seas, obviously, as mentioned just before the break, before the musical break, was and is a particular zone, a territory, a platform that we've got to look at that is not governed by all, but governed in a sense to say, hey, listen, this is the pavement we all need to work on, that we all need to interact with, and that needs to be free from a single person's or a smaller collective of countries' particular control. But that wasn't always like that. It wasn't always a scenario of, you know what, we can do whatever we want, until technically, which is still a situation. But the precursor sort of like event that took place, because before the Treaty of the High Seas, there's actually this particular global convention known as the Convention of the Law of the Sea. This particular convention, yes, don't worry, it's another UN entity. But this was a convention specifically that only came into effect in 1994 after it was signed in 1982. Now, between 1982 and 1994, there were a few countries that also became independent in between. For example, us, we were in that particular scope as well. And the convention's name, obviously, as I mentioned, the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas, or the Law of the Sea, is an international treaty that establishes the legal framework for all marine and maritime activities. Since 2024, 169 countries so far have signed, and the EU are also parties to the particular convention. The US is among the countries that have not ratified the treaty. So ratification, once again, just to let you know, is agreeing in principle with the spirit of the words. Not to say, yes, I will, adhere to what is written there. No. Ratification means I agree in principle with the aim of the treaty. It's the same thing with the AfCFTA. I will agree in principle. Now, the convention obviously resulted from another particular platform, which was the Conference on the Law of the Sea, which took place between 1973 and 1982. So the first particular, this particular convention replaced the four treaties of the 1958 convention of the high seas. And that particular convention, obviously, as you can see from 1958, meant there was a lot less countries who weren't all of them independent as well, participating to this particular agreement. Now, since 1994, when the current convention came into effect, which is also the year after Guyana became the 60th nation to ratify the treaty, and in 2023, an agreement was reached on the High Seas Treaty to be added as an instrument of the convention to protect ocean life and international waters. So the overall thing that protects all international waters outside of the especially economic zones of countries is this convention of the sea and the treaty of the high seas. So, all of this currently today, if you ask me what it is it all about, it is about environmental protection, specifically of aquatic aquatic habitats and scenarios. And animals, specifically in the aquatic sense, specifically in the seas, not in national waters or in, you know, river systems and lakes on land. And the main particular, and the other particular aim is also it would provide measures including marine protected areas and environmental impact assessments. Now, okay, before we actually continue, dear listeners, we've got a short ad popping up, and we'll be back right after this.
Großartige Neuigkeiten. Imba ist jetzt noch besser geworden. Wir haben brandneue Funktionen hinzugefügt, um dein Erlebnis noch reibungsloser, schneller und leistungsstärker zu machen als je zuvor. Bereit, das volle Potenzial von Imba freizuschalten? Erhalte alle exklusiven Funktionen für nur 36 Namibia-Dollar pro Monat oder spare noch mehr mit unserem speziellen Abonnementplänen. 5% Rabatt bei einem 3-Monats-Abonnement, 10% Rabatt bei einem 6-Monats-Abonnement oder 25% Rabatt bei einem 12-Monats-Abonnement. Wähle den Plan, der am besten zu dir passt und genieße alles, was Imba zu bieten hat, zu einem unschlagbaren Preis. Imba, where the world congregates. Lade es herunter und abonniere noch heute.
Coming back from the quick break right there, and you're still finding yourself here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, and this is my Sunday morning take here on your early Sunday morning sessions from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Now, just before the break, I was going to get, and I'm still getting into, well, the convention didn't exist back then. There were instances of a treaty or of agreements between naval powers at the time who were possibly also military powers on land. And it wasn't as smooth sailing as, you know, you as I outlined primarily right now, because at that stage, at a drop of a hand, that's now pre-1900 or before the First and the Second World Wars, the countries back then, firstly, a whole bunch of us were colonized. Secondly, a whole bunch of us probably didn't have the means to build the naval technology then. Thirdly, much of the recognition of, you know, proper independent states was also but problematic, because at a drop of a hat, you could be invaded and you could be colonized. And I mean it at a drop of a hat, that did happen. So it was a little bit tricky to technically envisage a situation where the whole of the world actually had the opportunity of reaching consensus about a law of the sea or laws of the seas for seagoing entities or nations that have navies, or even just for fishermen as well. Basic stuff. Now, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea replaces the older freedom of the seas concept. Now, the freedom of the seas concept was predominantly European. The freedom of the seas was a principle in the law of the sea. It stresses freedom to navigate the oceans, and it also disapproves of war fought in water. So you can obviously see the convention tries to build off of this particular principle. But the freedom is also to be breached only in a necessary international agreement. So what would this be? And what would it technically look like? Now, remember, the freedom of the seas is deemed as a concept. It's something that a country can say, hey, listen, we will do this regardless of how you view it. We will still act on, you know, maintaining this particular principle and thus not sign anything else. Now, this was a principle, this principle was one of Woodrow Wilson's, the US president's, 14 points that was proposed during the First World War. And it was made in a speech in the US Congress at the time, where he said, absolute freedom of navigation upon the seas outside territorial waters alike in peace and in war, except as the seas may be closed in whole or in part by international action for the enforcement of international covenants. But this was obviously at a time when the League of Nations, the precursor entity of the United Nations, existed. And the League of Nations at that stage wasn't much helpful. It literally wasn't much helpful. Now, the allies at the time for the United States, Great Britain and France, were opposed to this point. Now, you clearly could understand as to why they would be opposed to it. Because they historically had great reach, much involvement, great investment into naval power. And they probably thought, you know what? What is this guy's act? What is Wilson actually doing here? What is he saying? And just as I mentioned, the UK was also a considerable naval power at the time. As with Wilson's other points, a freedom of the seas was also rejected by the German government at the time. Now, today, the concept of the freedom of the seas can be found in the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, under Article 87, which states that the high seas are open to all states, whether coastal or landlocked, which literally was a Woodrow Wilson concept, which obviously the UN just adopted. Article 87 from subsection 1 from A to F also gives a non-exhaustive list of freedoms, which includes navigation, overflight, the laying of submarine cables, building of artificial islands, which China is doing, and fishing and scientific research. Everyone can do it in the high seas. Now, the obvious sentiment is a scenario of who possibly puts up the biggest defense regarding such particular developments. And the biggest defense that we saw back with Woodrow Wilson was obviously three of the European superpowers at the time, Great Britain, France, and Germany. Now, coming back to, you know, where this freedom of the seas concept actually originated from as well, was that you could also find traces of this concept back to the 17th century. Now, according to this concept, national rights were limited to a specific belt of road. Oh, no, sorry, not of road. I'm thinking about the Belt and Road Initiative. Of water from a nation's coastlines. So you had to measure literally 3 nautical miles, which is about 5.6 kilometers from your shoreline, from your beach, into the ocean. Currently right now, the national waters, or territorial waters as they call them, is actually 19 kilometers. I thought it was the whole 200 kilometers technically that, you know, that was needed. No, from that 19 kilometers, heading for a measurement of 200 kilometers still on sea is the special economic zone. So from Namibia's coastline, 19 kilometers into the sea is technically what is Namibia's national waters, or any other country's national waters is the same width. And outside that 19 is a special economic zone, which is the 200 kilometers, which is where you are allowed to do whatever you want to in that specific scenario, which is also the scenario in terms of where that American aircraft carrier the other day, back in last year month, technically hung outside the special economic zone waters of our country, obviously as it was making its way to, which is primarily Hormuz once again. Now, working on these particular measurements, at the time when it was still the 5.6 kilometers of length from the coastline, it was known as the cannon's shot, or the cannon shot rule. Now, the cannon shot rule was developed by a Dutch jurist, Cornelius van Beinkershoek, primarily because this was usually what would happen under blockades and naval warfare. You know, you go blockade someone's port facility and they would lie like 5 kilometers out to sea, but from that 5 kilometers, they can literally pound you with their cannons. You can't hit them from anywhere until obviously countries decided to build naval coastline fortresses with batteries. These are, you know, major cannons that can shoot way out to sea, specifically bombing any particular enemy ships. You could see if you wanted good example of this particular scenario, you would find it in from Angola all the way up to here, the neighborhood where you find Ghana and Nigeria, this West African neighborhood, but along the shoreline, you will find evidences of such particular fortresses that existed back then. Obviously, the fortresses had multiple roles that it played, but the fortresses were positioned literally on the shoreline, obviously as the closest fortified positions in terms of maintaining whatever economic activity is taking place on the shore or in the land, and thus acting as also a defensive position in terms of protecting your assets and your particular valuables. So, the cannon shot rule, you have to understand, was not a nice rule actually to have, even though the rule technically was made active by, you know, the observations and the particular insights given at the time. Now, all waters beyond national boundaries were also considered in under the previous concept, the freedom of the seas concept, as being international waters. So they didn't have the special economic zone situation where you work from 5 kilometers out at sea, you count another, what they call that thing? The 5 kilometers here. So the 19 kilometers. So from 19 kilometers, then you measure the 200 kilometers extra on the sea in terms of that being your overall zone of influence specifically into disease. Now, obviously, the freedom of the seas concept promoted a scenario where international waters is free to all nations, but belonging to none of them. There was a legal principle brought in known as Mare Liberum. Now, Mare Liberum, dear listeners, is the terms of international waters or transboundary waters that apply where any of the following types of bodies of water transcend international boundaries. Oceans, large marine ecosystems, enclosed or semi-enclosed regional seas and estuaries, rivers, lakes, ground, seawater systems, like aquifers, for that matter. And Namibia obviously finds itself specifically like, for example, that aquifer that covers, that spans into Botswana, from Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa, in terms of that transboundary element. So, in the earliest 20th century, some nations expressed their desire to extend national claims. And obviously, lo and behold, in many scenarios, it was based upon fish stocks. It was based upon mineral resources and also to provide the means to enforce some pollution controls. Now, the League of Nations at the time called a 1930 conference at The Hague, but no agreements actually came about from it. Using the customary international law principle of a nation's right to protect its natural resources, the American president, Harry Truman, in 1945 extended the U.S. control to all natural resources of its continental shelf. Let me say that again. Truman extended U.S. control to all natural resources of its continental shelf. Which is big. Which is way too big. Other nations were quick to follow suit. Between 1946 and 1950, Chile, Peru, and Ecuador extended their rights to a distance of at least 200 nautical miles to cover the Humboldt Current fishing grounds. Other nations extended their territorial seas to 12 nautical miles. By 1967, only 25 nations still used the old 3 nautical mile rule, while 66 nations at the time had set a 12 nautical mile territorial limit, and 8 had set a 200 nautical mile limit. As of 15 July of 2011, only Jordan still uses the 3 mile limit, which is the cannon shot rule, technically. And remember, Jordan is technically landlocked. Technically, Jordan is landlocked. Now, that limit is also used in certain Australian islands, an area of Belize, on some Japanese straits, certain areas of Papua New Guinea, and a few of the British overseas territories, such as Gibraltar. Now, UNCLOS, which is the Convention of the Seas, or the Law of the Seas, does not deal with matters of territorial disputes or to resolve issues of sovereignty, as that particular field is actually governed by rules of customary international law on the acquisition and loss of territory. The United Nations Sustainable Development Goal, which is Goal 14, also had a target regarding conservative and sustainable use of oceans and their resources in line with the UNCLOS legal framework. But when you start from the Convention on the Law of the Seas, back in 1958, which was obviously the sort of like the main starting point for all of this, was that back in 1958, the UN held its first conference of the Law of the Sea in Geneva. And it resulted in 4 treaties that took place then. Now remember, we as Namibia, we weren't there. We weren't there. We only got our independence in 1990, but we were not there. the four treaties that obviously took shape back in 1958 was the Good Treaty, or the Convention of the Territorial Sea and the Contiguous Zone, which only came into force on 10 September 1964. The next was the Convention of the Continental Shelf, which came in also into force on 10 June 1964. The third was the Convention on the High Seas, which came into force on 30 September 1962. And finally, it was the Convention on Fishing and Conservation of Living Resources of the High Seas, which came into effect on 20 March 1966. Now, you heard about the continental shelf aspect that a country like America applied in 1945. But the Convention on the Continental Shelf was an international treaty that created to codify the rules of international law relating to continental shelves. So the continental shelf is technically what you are based upon. The continental shelf, in a way, it doesn't represent the actual landmass that your country is based upon, but it does technically also represent an aspect which impacts, for example, mining and other extractive sectors, because in some cases you'll find some countries technically are the continental shelf that they exist on. For example, Australia and New Zealand are on this, you know, it's one of the previously unknown continents. For example, New Zealand is on it, but they technically are feature on the continental shelf that they find themselves on. Now, the treaty, after entering into force in 1964, established the rights of sovereign states over the continental shelf surrounding these states. So yes, they did have sort of like earlier formations of of these particular treaties. But before we continue, dear listeners, with the rest of the iterations of the Convention on the Law of the Seas, we'll take another short musical break and we'll come back right after this.
Little Debbie's from the corner store, car bruises at Hillside, drinking that fruit punch on a Saturday. Brandon dancing on the front porch, his big brother was George. He'd always borrow my tapes and lose them things. Rock, paper, scissors, 'cause you know the winner would be the first to play Nintendo 64. In the summertime, on the south side, it's alright. In the summertime, on the south side, it's just fine in Panther City. All the crackheads and prostitutes on Rosedale, my father said go straight home, oh I catch hell. Don't walk around them streets at night. There was a girl, she lived on Pinky Street, her name was Jamie. I used to drive our house every day. That was my first taste of love. In the summertime, on the south side, it's alright. In the summertime, on the south side, it's just fine. In Panther City,
other night I rolled down Cannon to remind myself and feel something. To remind myself and feel something. In the summertime, on the south side, it's alright. In the summertime, yeah, 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 yeah. In the summertime, on the south side, it's alright.
Coming back there from the sound specifically of Sade with the song Sweetest Taboo, as you obviously heard there, with a little bit of rain sprinkled at the start and the end of the song. Yeah, it obviously speaks also to a particular different time back then when the music was actually made with instruments and not with a synthesizer. However, bring us back to the Laws of the Seas discussion that we just had before the musical break. And obviously, you and my company, we're in the second half, obviously, of this morning's program. And from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. here on your number one talker station, here on your Sunday morning sessions. There's no first light indications yet from what I can see. So, yeah, so stay warm wherever you find yourself specifically and try to, well, should I say relax in a way? Well, not really. But where we left off, the first particular convention obviously laid some foundations of things. This was obviously 1958. But most of the particular points actually only came into effect in 1966. By the latest, 1966, and it obviously was sort of like the foundational, treaty to work from. You get to UNCLOS 2, which is the convention on the Law of the Seas, number 2, where in 1960, the United Nations held the second conference on the Law of the Sea. However, the six-week Geneva conference did not result in any new agreements. Generally speaking, the developing nations and the third world countries at that time who participated were only participating as clients, as allies, or as dependents of the US or of the Soviet Union, which was, what you can obviously see is a major issue regarding how some of the particular conventions actually were administered, were conducted, or were actually, put into force. It was that you had these two opposing sides pulling on global development, specifically what particular perspective a country needs to have on a global scale. So these countries had no significant voice of their own, which is the issue we find ourselves in today. Why do I say today specifically? It's because the small island nations primarily are the biggest ones at threat, specifically of any kinds of either climatic events, which can pose a significant threat even to the island nation's overall safety and overall existence and overall operations. You have the island nations of like Nauru and Tuvalu on the other side of Samoa and Tonga, who continuously complain primarily of that rising sea levels are an issue for them, which is the truth, which is a fact. Rising sea levels are an issue for them. UNCLOS 3 came about. On the horizon once again, because UNCLOS 2 didn't actually generate anything concrete, but UNCLOS 1 basically sort of like laid a template of everything. With UNCLOS 3, the issue of the varying claims of territorial waters once was raised again at the UN in 1967 by Arvid Pardo of Malta. And in 1973, the third UN conference of the Law of the Sea convened in New York. Now, in an attempt to reduce the possibility of groups of nation states dominating the negotiations, because technically that's what happened with UNCLOS 2, and in UNCLOS 3, the conference used a consensus process rather than a majority rule, with more than 160 nations actually participating in this. The conference then lasted until 1982. The resulting convention came into force on 16 November 1994, 1 year after the 60th state, that being Guyana, ratified the treaty. Now, the convention introduced a number of provisions. The first was the issues that covered were setting of limits, the navigation, the archipelagic status and transit regimes, exclusive economic zones, continental shelf jurisdiction, deep seabed mining, the exploitation regime, the protection of marine environment and scientific research and the settlement of disputes. Which is important to move forward primarily because it helps to look into the aspects, obviously, of where disputes and certain particular claims are supposedly led or placed, which is currently one of the biggest talking points, if you ever think about it. Now, the convention also set the limit over various other areas, measured from a carefully defined baseline, and these other areas obviously looked at internal waters, which are rivers and lakes, archipelagic waters, or under internal waters, remember also that you've got underground water resources, the aquifers. The other particular areas that were also looked at were archipelagic waters, territorial seas, contiguous zones, exclusive economic zones, and the continental shelf. Under internal waters, this particular subset, before we continue, dear listeners, we'll quickly take a caller's contribution. Eagle FM, good morning.
Morning, Dwight. Hukwande.
Hukwande, danke, bona.
Okay. What can you tell, man?
Wat het nou weer gebeur aan Gabona? What's happening?
That's next me. How come your men say you don't so bad? Nie mooi nie. It's longer that the resource had plat most. How come?
It's a partnership rule, Angabona. Let me rather just keep it on a diplomatic side. It's a partnership rule.
It's a partnership.
Yeah, it's a partnership rule.
So yeah.
I have raised it, but it's a partnership rule. So, and sometimes I don't sit on this side of the studio. I sit on the other side where I don't can't see the button.
Oh my God, man.
Yeah.
So many information and knowledge is just going on wasted.
Yeah.
Because what you are dishing out is more variable than the partnership action. Because this goes beyond our borders. Even those conventions that you are talking about, whether they are respected, so they give effect to us and many, many other institutions. But what do we see now? Even if we put those borders, the sovereignty is there, the territory, all these common laws that you're talking about. It's a partnership, I understand, but whom does it benefit?
It's also a thing, Angabona, a scary thing, primarily of what we saw on 3 January this year with Venezuela.
Yeah.
So if you don't remember, Angabona, you remember there were a bunch of boats that the Americans claimed that they attacked and intercepted boats that were leaving what's its name? Venezuela's national waters. And then the boats were obviously shot at, people died, and it was I think like 3 or 4 boats that suffered the same fate. And it's one of these particular things in terms of is a country actually at war with another country? Because at that stage, the Americans didn't define to anyone whether they are at war with Venezuela. And they also had to, you know, make their case in the UN context, which obviously Donald Trump said he is not going to adhere to any UN scenarios. So technically, the United States is basically a rogue nation by their own definitions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, but now I think won't they be? I think it's just. I understand. No voice, no this thing, bulldozing your way out. But now that they had some conversation with the president of China, and so many global things are happening, those current events, political and all these other things, don't you think that very soon we will start respecting those international conventions and the rules that are there?
But that's the concerning about it. He must try how many treaties? UN treaties? Literally in January, this same year, just after what they did to Venezuela, they announced that they had successfully withdrawn from most UN treaties. I just want to get that list, Angabona, but it's something like almost more than 60 international treaties, which everything falls under the UN, which technically makes the United States a rogue nation, because they are technically saying they don't want to recognize the UN, the same thing that they started. They are almost the brainchild, it's almost a brainchild, or it's a product of the Americans, the UN, because it's based in New York City, and they can't make a claim for what they're actually accusing the entity of. They're saying was that the UN is being used by other nations there was a word that Marco Rubio used. It's sort of like other countries are controlling the UN for their benefit, but it is exactly what the Americans are also did or used the UN for, them and the Soviet Union back in the 50s. They represented other countries, like, for example, at this Law of the Seas Convention, and they told the other countries, hey, listen, since you're my ally, I will speak on behalf of you. So they've been doing this historically. Yeah.
So they consider us as a non-entity and all this other thing. But you know, I'm just praying that at least things will change very soon.
Eish, Angabona. Eish, it's a tall order with Donald Trump.
Now, what is how is the current situation? The war now between the war that the invasion of America and Israel
In Iran.
Iran and all these things. How is the situation?
I don't know, Angabona, because it's either open, then it's either closed, then there's arguments, then there's words. So far, it seems like the fight...
After Trump has returned from China, what are the developments from there?
It's basically, the latest one is just basically saying, Iran saying that the strait is open. As long as the ships that are there recognize the rules that the Iranians have put down. Because the Strait, Angabona, actually is closer to the Iranian side than it is to the, what's that country's name? Is it UAE or is it Kuwait? One of the two. There's a large portion that falls on the Iranian side of the Strait. So you will anyway have to go into the Iranian, national water sense, to technically get your ship out, because the other way around is a lot smaller and it makes it tricky to navigate.
So, but yeah, I have heard him saying that it's open and all these things. And other ships have been passing through, isn't it?
Yeah. If you are India and China, you get allowed.
You go.
Yeah.
So let's see. So, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Not a problem.
So, now I'm saying that partnership. So, of course, we have got the voice.
Yeah.
We have got all these things. Is it a rule now that when you guys start at 5 with your comedian partner, so there shouldn't be any interactions or any kind of interaction, or it's just that maybe it's just conservative more?
Angabona, I actually encourage it. So I'll just remind him again in terms of...
You remind who?
My partner was now. That's why.
Who's the one to decide now for us or what?
That was why I said, Angelon, I don't sit this side. I sit on the other side during in the week. So I don't sit this side in terms of being in charge of the controls.
These are his questions. It's not the queries. It's not yours.
Yeah.
But we have to do it because you are open to us. You know, that kind of door, open door policy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know whether maybe because the... Maybe it's another kind of way of doing things because we have always promoted, and you guys have done it, and the leadership and management, open kind of dialogue, you understand, where you constructive kind of input and criticism and things like that, because it's education.
It is, and it's actually discourse, Angabona.
We are reverting back to the system of apartheid, where Elena doesn't have anything to contribute.
Yeah, they're just supposed to absorb.
Education is the depository kind of education.
Yeah.
Banging kind of education.
Mm.
So even yourself, you should reflect you. I mean, this is how you do things most, you know, from school where you are. Why are we now trying to... revert back to the system which does really deprive a lot of people from important information, essential information. Why?
I'll stress it again, Angabona. I will stress it again.
No, it's very disturbing.
Yeah.
It's very, very disturbing.
Mm.
Very completely disturbing, and it's wasting of time.
Mm.
So that product would be utilized better. I understand the information that you are giving, but what feedback do you get?
Mm.
So it's just very frustrating anyway.
Mm.
Even if it was in the class, we will all walk out. In the lecture, continue lecturing.
Mm. I'll share with him, Angabona.
It's very disturbing.
Mm.
So, I mean, there's no way we can tell. Maybe he's only say if you don't want it, so put off the radio or whatever. But we cannot put it off because we are accustomed to this. This is where we benefit in terms of education and information.
Mm.
So what kind of legal, what is this? The legal law, I understand, it's legitimate. Nobody can argue about it because of the power that you have. Is that not misuse of it? Thank you, man.
No, don't worry, Angabona. Don't worry.
On Salvier Prat.
Okay, Angabona.
Now, as we head into the last quarter of this morning session specifically, where we left off, as you heard there specifically with the caller's contribution, it is a scenario, the high seas is a scenario that actually also has its linkages, its tethers into many other aspects and also events currently taking place, even today. But much of it obviously also speaks towards the kinds of control that can be exerted on other nations by larger nations at the time. Remember, you've got scenarios of countries like the United States that basically come and tell you, hey, listen, you know, the continental shelf is our actual zone of influence. Now, the continental shelf in the North American context would technically include Mexico and Canada as well, because Mexico and Canada are not detached from the United States. They're literally connected to the United States. So they do have borders, land borders with each other. And they, you know, what would be deemed as their national waters technically are connected to each other as well. So it does make it tricky when a country claims continental shelf, sort of like zone of influence, in terms of highlighting where is what and who's got what and whose particular national waters is where. And it's a scenario where it actually looks pretty big, because when you say your national water is actually your continental shelf, or that's the line where it actually starts from or it extends to, it could be a scenario of at least, more than the 19 kilometers that I stated. Because, for example, in the North American scenario, this could be as far as 500 kilometers. 500 kilometers in a direction into the sea. This is one of the photos primarily that I've got here in front of me that highlight this. And it makes the particular zone large, because even another particular zone of continents around the world, certain continental shelves obviously are slightly smaller than others. Others are way much bigger than others, but it does make it a little bit tricky because it extends the shoreline pretty much. We obviously face a particular scenario in terms of understanding, when you get to the understanding of territorial waters. Where do a lot of these particular things actually lead us to? Because yes, zone of influence, sovereignty are the other particular aspects that, play key roles. But aside from the provisions specifically in defining ocean boundaries, the convention at the time, which was the third one, the one that obviously, that is UNCLOS 3, which laid down all these other particular sort of like subset conventions, it established general obligations for safeguarding the marine environment and protecting freedom of scientific research on the high seas, and also created an innovative legal regime for controlling mineral resource exploitation in deep seabed areas beyond national jurisdiction through the International Seabed Authority. I did not know there was such an authority, the Seabed Authority. And this also incorporated the Common Heritage of Mankind principle. The Common Heritage of Mankind principle is obviously a principle that represents all the skills and achievements of humanity or the human race, which are held to be shared by all. As a principle of the international law, it holds that the defined territorial areas and elements of humanity's common heritage should be held in trust for all. For example, we should all have access radio. It's one of those particular developments discoveries that obviously have to create the particular shared benefit. Another one is obviously the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. This particular tribunal actually was established by UNCLOS 3. Specifically, obviously, to try and deal with any kinds of disputes that would exist. The International Seabed Authority is another interesting particular development, because this authority, based in Jamaica, is also a intergovernmental body whereby 171 member states are party to it, plus the European Union, and it was established in 1982 under UNCLOS 3. So it aims to play a particular pivotal role. Now, since we talk about the seas, the seas still have much secrets, or contains much secrets that we still have to discover and to actually, to reveal in as it currently is, like since it's an entity that covers about 70% of the global Earth's surface, the seas still greatly stay unexplored as we see them today. Even though we travel a lot on them, you know, with all the particular naval travel, with maritime travel taking place, the concern has always been, you know, what exists below the surface of the seas. Much of it, as has been highlighted in history, has been fishing resources and other potential minerals. And they're talking about a new mineral that is on the seabed of a certain part of the sea, of the oceans, specifically the Atlantic Ocean. It is a particular rare earth mineral that has to be mined out of the seabed in that scenario. And it's obviously a discussion of, you know, how do you look at this in terms of extracting directly out of the oceans? And, you know, how does it impact marine life as well? But then came another particular aspect of this convention of the law of the sea. Now, part 11, or is this part 9? No, part 11 of the convention provides for a regime relating to minerals on the seabed outside any state's territorial waters, the particular talking point I just highlighted before this, or any exclusive economic zones. It establishes an international seabed authority, which is that authority, ISA, to authorize seabed exploration and mining and collect and distribute the seabed mining royalty. On 1 February of 2011, this particular authority also established the Seabed Disputes Chamber of the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, which issued an advisory opinion concerning the legal responsibilities and obligations of state parties to the convention with respect to the sponsorship of activities in the area in accordance with Part 9 of the convention and the 1994 agreement. So the advisory opinion was issued in response to a formal request, which was made by the International Seabed Authority following two prior applications that the authority's legal and technical commission had received from Nauru and from Tonga, the two countries, two island states, regarding proposed activities, which was technically to be undertaken in the area by two state-sponsored contractors, the Nauru Ocean Resources Incorporated, which is sponsored by the Republic of Nauru, and the Tonga Offshore Mining Limited, sponsored by the Kingdom of Tonga. So what was the issue at hand? It's literally the mineral, the rare earth mineral that I just spoke about. These are polymetallic nodules. They're found... Okay, so Nauru and Tonga are obviously in the Pacific Ocean. And these polymetallic nodules are such rare earth minerals, specifically. The biggest concentration is perceived to be in the seas. But polymetallic nodules are so far... in some cases, below the Earth's below the sea surface, but they look like a potato, but they're technically nodes of metal, just sitting there. They're often called manganese nodules as well, because they look like a potato-sized mineral sort of like node that just sits there, and it's found in deep sea areas on the ocean floor primarily. These manganese nodules are mineral concretions on the sea bottom that is formed of concentric layers of iron and manganese hydroxides. So technically the things just sit there at the bottom of the ocean. And obviously they are continuously attracting interest in that regard as well, primarily because of the need for more iron and for more manganese in the world, primarily to help with, you know, other industrial aspects as it goes on. Now, the advisory obviously highlighted that the state-sponsored activities do not harm the marine environment, and that it stays consistent, the activities, with the applicable provisions of UNCLOS 3 and Part 11 specifically, the authorities' regulations, the ITLOS case law, the tribunal of the law of the seas, and other international environmental treaties. Part 12 of the UNCLOS agreement, which is about protecting marine environment, also, you know, holds the special provisions for the protection of the marine environment, obviously obligating all states to collaborate in this matter, which is a little bit tricky sometimes. You don't obviously get to see how they do the collaboration unless there's like high profile engagement regarding the resource itself. But UNCLOS 3 obviously aims to heighten the role of collaboration between countries across the world, specifically with this particular shared resource. Now, it has a mechanism also of placing special obligations on flag states to ensure that ships under their flags adhere to international environmental regulations, which is obvious, which is adopted more often at the other UN body, the International Maritime Organization. But then there's also MARPOL, which is the convention, which is the International Convention for the Prevention of Pollution from Ships, which is the 1973 convention, and it was modified by the Protocol of 1978 as to become the most important international marine environmental convention, so as to ensure that pollution from ships and shipping is actually lessened. And we did that particular discussion on the home run a little bit earlier in the year, obviously looking at the future fuels in shipping specifically, and then there was also the other international maritime discussion about the agreement that had to take place earlier this year, specifically in February or January itself, from the IMO. Now, the High Seas Treaty, which we highlighted at the start of our show for this morning, obviously aims to bring in the countries across the world. It's 160, give or take, slightly more, that obviously participate in this treaty. But the concern is obviously, you know, who are the countries that are not participating? And the question as to why they're not participating as such. Much of the particular indication from this is obviously that some countries obviously believe that there are main aspects that need to be binding. For example, there is a new convention known as the Biological Diversity of Areas Beyond National Jurisdiction Agreement. It's also another UN convention, but there's only 17 countries who technically signed on to this thing. Bangladesh, Barbados, Belize, Chile, Cuba, France, Maldives, Mauritius, Micronesia, Monaco, which I don't know how it is a separate country, but nonetheless, Palau, Panama, Seychelles, Singapore, Spain, St. Lucia, and Timor-Leste. They are the 17 countries that are parties to this agreement, but there's actually 110 countries that signed on this particular agreement, and it was ratified by 60 countries back in 2023. Obviously, this aims to look at the pollution aspect of shipping and of, you know, potential pollution in various aspects in not just the high seas, but also in national waters, because there's a lot of things that happen that ships do in terms of how they dispose of their waste, and sometimes they do actually pollute directly into a natural environment. Now, the interesting thing, obviously, to the broader discussion that takes place has been who are the parties, who are non-parties, who are signatories, and possibly who refuses to just participate. Now, just to let you know, when it comes to the Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS, the current level, there's a whole bunch of countries that are not parties or signatories to UNCLOS. First and foremost, obviously, you've got the United States. First and foremost, you always have to look at, this is my particular internal process myself. When it comes to like a global discussion of something, I always look for the Security Council representatives. Is France there? Is the UK there? Is Germany, not Germany, is Russia there? And is China there? In this UNCLOS discussion, all countries represented by the EU are there, is there. The UK is even there. Canada is even there. India and China is definitely there. Russia is definitely there. But the disappointing thing to look into is specifically that one of the world's greatest and largest shipping sort of like nations, the United States, is not a signatory to UNCLOS. They're not even a party. They didn't sign. They're not even a party to this particular scenario, which actually helps to explain what the claim that Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, have been making since last year. It seems like they don't like it when other countries have an agenda also to post or to place or an item of concern that needs to be clarified at a UN level for global, to deal with a global issue, which is everyone on the high seas. When I highlight this this specific example, or this, put on sort of like on a micro level, highlighting this particular example, you sit with an understanding of. So this makes things a little bit tricky with dealing with this, with countries like this. Another one is obviously Libya. Libya is also not a party to this particular. They're not a signatory as well. Then you've got, I think this is, it doesn't look like Venezuela, but it could be Venezuela and Brazil, Venezuela and Colombia. You have Ethiopia, Ethiopia's other two neighbors. I think that is South Sudan, and then there's another country there. I think, Central African Republic. And then you've got Iran, that's also not part of it. Iran and Iraq, and Turkey, and much of the Caucasus. The Caucasus are now the Tajikistans, Uzbekistans, I think that's Azerbaijan, I think. Azerbaijan, and, yeah, in a nutshell, yes. So, and North Korea, definitely. Because North Korea is technically not part of the UN as well. So, yeah. Now, on that particular note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end of our subject or our topic for this morning's discussion. We'll quickly be taking a short musical break. And after that, we'll come back heading into our saying our goodbyes, which is at the end of the show. And we'll be back right after this.
What is love but a stranger's to feelings? a sin you swallow for the rest of your life. You've been looking for someone to believe in, to love you until your eyes run dry. Oh, little girls, I got a reaction.
Titanium, the perfect fit between platinum and silver, complementing our existing benefit options. We always offer a comprehensive healthcare experience. NHP, the premier member-centric medical aid fund. Visit NHP today at nhp.com.na. NHP, we're about you.
What's not to love about Yusei's special mid-May combo? For just $219 million, you can get 5 bags of essential food items, 5 kilos of Champion Super Maize meal, 2.5 kilograms of Bokoma Fed cooked flour, 2 kilograms of nice rice, 1 kilogram of sliced grande pasta, and 2 kilograms of marathon sugar. That's just $219 million for 5 bags of essential products. Yes, we all save at Yusei.
Slay until I feel nice. A sugar and spice. I feel nice, a sugar and spice.
Lonely crowd.
And that does bring us up to the end for this morning session, specifically of My Sunday Morning Take, dear listeners, and obviously with the extended musical break right there, which pushed it just past the top of the hour at 7 a.m. We do have to say our goodbyes, and obviously good morning to those of you that only woke up right now. Obviously, do stay in tuned for the rest of your conversation and your content, as well as also the rest of the programming here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. We'll see each other again same time. Okay, not same time, same place. That'll be next Sunday, but same time during the course of the week for the home run here on Eagle FM.